This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of March 16th, 2026. New sexual abuse allegations against the late civil rights leader Cesar Chavez are putting Arizona cities and even the state in the spotlight over if or how they plan to celebrate Cesar Chavez Day, Matthew Casey reports.
The allegations that Chavez engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior with women and girls were first reported by the New York Times less than 2 weeks before Cesar Chavez Day on March 31st. Governor Katie Hobbs's press secretary tells KJZZ that her office will not recognize the holiday this year. In Phoenix, the mayor's office says the council will vote next week on whether to rename the city holiday, as well as buildings bearing Chavez's name, and remove all city street signs honoring him. In a statement, Mayor Kate Gallego said there is a duty to honor the dignity of survivors. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In business news, across Arizona, cities, farms, and tribes are trying to cope with the impacts of drought, but doing that is expensive. Lately, a new source of money has been helping fuel water conservation projects. As Alex Hager reports, big companies are starting to chip in.
It's a cool morning in the desert, and water is rushing through a canal next to a field of crops. This water is used by the Gila River Indian community, south of Phoenix. David DeYoung manages irrigation here, and he's watching the water spill out onto a field of alfalfa through a system of high-tech motorized gates.
As the water advances, that sensor's picking up where the water is at.
DeYoung says they used to run water across this field for 8 to 12 hours to get it fully soaked, but now it only takes about one.
The key here is to get the water across the field as quickly as possible.
The Gila River Indian community has made its water conservation work highly visible over the past few years, accepting big checks from the federal government to make its water systems more efficient and to leave the water it's not using in Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir. But now, it's not just the feds helping foot the bill.
You might be wondering, why is a consumer products company standing here in the middle of Arizona? Why are we supporting a great project like this?
That's Shannon Quinn with Procter & Gamble. Her company, along with Google, paid for more than half of this new irrigation system.
Water is essential to our business. We need it to make our product, and everyone needs it to use our product. Washing your hair with Pantene or doing your laundry with Tide. We need water and good quality water for consumers to be able to use our products.
Companies are stepping up their investments in water conservation for two big reasons. Todd Reeve knows them well. He's the CEO of Bonneville Environmental Foundation, which connects companies with money, like P&G, to people who can put it to work in conservation, like the Gila River Indian community. For a while, he says corporations were too focused on the short term, and he couldn't convince them that water shortages would hurt their business. But then,
all of a sudden, there was a sort of an awakening that all these places that companies thought, hey, we have no water risk at all, they realized, like, we've got exposure, we've got risk, and we need to pay attention.
The second reason, Reeve says, is about reputation. As the West gets drier, do you want people thinking your company is making it worse or trying to help?
When we're facing long-term drought, we're facing water cutbacks, etc. Instead of people pointing fingers, which is usually what happens right away, is people will say, you know, this company has been a partner here for 10 years, helping Arizona do more with less water.
The Biden administration spent billions on water infrastructure in the West, but that spending has gone way down under Trump. Reeve says corporate money can't replace that spending, but it can help.
There's a huge opportunity to use corporate money in very flexible ways to fill some of these critical gaps that are not being met by federal funding at present.
Nate Reese agrees with that. He's the Arizona director for the conservation group Trout Unlimited.
It's broadened the pool of funding for sure and just diversified it.
Reese's group is spearheading a big meadow restoration project in eastern Arizona. It's designed to improve wildlife habitat and make the space more resilient to drought. Trout Unlimited got federal money for the behind-the-scenes part of the project. Then a foundation and two companies, including Microsoft, kicked in about 40% of the total cost to get it across the finish line.
Federal dollars cover, at least in my case, have covered planning portions of these projects, and then corporates come in for implementation on the landscape.
Reese says this meadow restoration was a good chance for his group to show companies how far their money can go. So next time, they might be willing to pay for even more.
We've now learned a lot, built a lot of relationships, and so I'm hoping with these next ones I have in the pipeline that I've talked about, just giving corporations more opportunity to come and play.
Arizona is poised to stay dry, and the need for water conservation and the money to pay for it is likely to keep going up. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In aging news, women have made sacrifices in wartime since the Revolutionary War, but their service hasn't always been recognized. The same is true for women and men who served in the Vietnam War, boots on the ground who were often overlooked after they came home. Kathy Ritchie recently spoke with a group of veterans working to support and honor those aging service members.
It's a Tuesday morning at the Avondale Senior Resource Center. A group of veterans are listening to Coral Hoffman, a retired Navy chief, talk about who inspired her to join.
I had a great-great-grandfather that was in the Union Army during the Civil War.
This is the monthly meeting of the nonprofit Veterans Affinity. Their mission? Help senior vets access things like VA health care, benefits, and housing.
My grandfather was 14 years old and went into World War I and celebrated his 15th birthday over in Normandy. My dad was in the Korean War, so I felt the need to honor their service and do my duty.
By serving in Gulf War I and II, women have long been active in America's wars, from following their husbands in the Revolutionary War, where they did laundry or gathered supplies, to serving as nurses and spies in the Civil War. In Vietnam, women continued to serve, mostly as nurses. Many of the roughly 11,000 women who are in country worked near combat areas, endured extraordinarily long hours, often under difficult conditions, while also handling mass casualty events like the Tet Offensive.
They opened up doors, and so you can't help yourself to say welcome home and thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for opening the path. And hopefully I did the same thing.
Retired Navy Senior Chief Joyce Canlin served in the Cold War era, that period after Vietnam and before the Second Gulf War and Afghanistan. She went to her first Veterans Affinity meeting 16 months ago.
Veterans Affinity kind of saved my backside. When I retired, I had a difficult time. I felt like a piece of a puzzle, but I was just a piece, but I couldn't find the rest of the puzzle. Where did I fit?
Canlin describes herself as direct, and navigating civilian life was hard. She says she was made fun of. People would say things like Roger, or quiz her about why she backed her car into a parking spot.
Because of the mortars in Iraq, when you have to run with your vehicle, you can't afford to back out, you have to pull out.
After that meeting, she kept coming back.
And then I heard they volunteered to help people that are shut-ins, people like who are amputees from Iraq or Agent Orange from Vietnam. And I said, I want a piece of that. And my little piece of my puzzle found it was the piece I was looking for so I can complete me.
Retired Army Command Sergeant Major Rick Kreiberg founded Veterans Affinity after serving for 35 years.
The challenge that I see is that society as a whole, we address the veterans that we can see and we can hear.
It's a squeaky wheel gets the grease situation.
But the veterans are Vietnam era and older. A lot of them are in long-term care facilities. A lot of them don't wear caps, nothing. They don't identify themselves as a veteran. And so they're forgotten and they fade away. What we do is we go find them.
And invite them to a meeting like this one on this day, where donuts and coffee are served, stories are shared, along with plenty of good-natured ribbing. Anita Jones is a Vietnam-era Navy veteran. She didn't serve in country, but she remembers what it was like for those coming home.
World War II, it was like they were so welcomed when they came home. They had ticker tape parades. Vietnam, they had nothing.
And the women who were saving American and Vietnamese lives?
The women coming back, even that, they weren't welcomed. None of our military were welcomed.
According to the VA, there's limited information about the women who served in Vietnam and the medical issues they may have faced related to things like Agent Orange, PTSD, or other traumas. Here's Rick Kreiberg again.
So having a Vietnam veteran, Vietnam War veteran, connect with a Vietnam War veteran, because they understand what they went through, okay? You have a woman veteran that can connect with another woman veteran because they know how they feel and what they went through.
Kreiberg says it's a lot like a matchmaking game, and sometimes it's kismet.
Oh my God, you were on the same ship in Vietnam and you don't know each other? Things like that happen.
Something else happens too. They start talking about their experiences with each other and with people like me, a civilian.
If we would have done this a year ago, you wouldn't have got the same story today. Those three women are evolving. So the story that they told today is much longer, much more in depth than it was a year ago.
Because talking about it here, in a space where the people share the same language and a similar history, well, it provides some closure for many of these veterans who've been holding on to the trauma, the grief, that moral injury that is the result of war. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, the United States and Mexico are starting talks this week as the two countries and Canada review the trade pact that binds them. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky has more.
Mexico is aiming to keep the USMCA trade deal in place as it also looks to end new tariffs on certain goods not covered by the treaty. The bilateral talks between the US and Mexico this week come ahead of the six-year anniversary of that trade pact this summer. The treaty is up for its first six-year review after going into place under the first Trump administration. President Trump has suggested the United States could leave or dramatically change the treaty his own administration negotiated to replace NAFTA. Mexico is Arizona's largest trading partner. The state imported $14 billion worth of goods from Mexico last year, according to the University of Arizona. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In politics news, Democrats and Republicans came together in court Wednesday morning to attack the Secretary of State's office for allowing a third party to change its name. From the politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
Arizona approved the creation of the No Labels Party in 2023, but 2 years later, a Ninth Circuit court ruling barred the party from only choosing candidates for high-level offices. So the National No Labels Party ended its affiliation with the state party, which then renamed itself the Arizona Independent Party. However, Democrats and Republicans claim Secretary of State Adrian Fuentes shouldn't have allowed the change. They argue he exceeded his authority and opened the doorway to voter confusion. Attorneys for Fuentes say he would have overstepped by not allowing the name change. Both sides agree there's no law clarifying what the Secretary of State is allowed to do in that situation. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge George Como says he'll make a ruling within 1 week. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In tribal natural resources, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has denied requests that it block the transfer of public land known as Oak Flat to the private mining company Resolution Copper. As Matthew Casey reports, this clears the way for mining after a decades-long legal battle.
Oak Flat is a popular campground and sacred Apache site that sits on top of one of the world's largest copper deposits. Now, more than 2,400 acres have been transferred to the company Resolution Copper. The Ninth Circuit notes that this will fundamentally alter the land, including destruction of sites revered by Native Americans. Conservationists with the Sierra Club call the decision devastating but say the legal fight isn't over. Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva says the site was traded in a backroom deal that ignored tribal sovereignty. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, a deep dive on the destruction in the remote Arizona wilderness to make way for more border wall. Here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
One of the last wild open spaces along the U.S.-Mexico border is being blown up by crews who are building the president's border wall at a furious pace. It's in Coronado National Monument in southeastern Arizona, funded by more than $46 billion in federal dollars from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed through Congress last year. During President Trump's first term, areas like these, mountainous, environmentally sensitive, were left out of the campaign to build a border wall, but not anymore. And our first guest this morning got a firsthand look at the demolition that's taking place and its environmental stakes. Nick Miroff is a staff writer at The Atlantic who covers immigration, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Nick. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So, you were there watching some of this demolition taking place. Just tell us first, you know, what you saw.
Yeah, so I was watching from an overlook at Coronado National Memorial, as you say, right along the U.S.-Mexico border, where the Trump administration's crews are blowing up parts of national parkland to sort of smooth out the path for the construction of the border wall. And this is part of a segment that goes right through the middle of the San Rafael Valley in southern Arizona. And this is, as you said, one of the last open rangelands in this part of really along the entire U.S.-Mexico border, and was one of those kind of remote and sensitive areas that was, you know, didn't get touched during his first administration. But now that, you know, the administration has all this money to spend, it is building 30-foot, you know, black painted border wall right through the middle of this area.
Right. How many miles are they planning on building in this area?
So this segment is about 30 miles. It goes from the Huachuca Mountains at Coronado National Memorial and connects all the way over through the Patagonia Mountains across the San Rafael Valley. And then, you know, that's going to connect on the other side with the segments that are east of Nogales.
Right. And you mentioned it's painted black. Why is that?
The president has insisted that the border wall be painted black because he thinks it's going to be hotter to the touch and that he likes the way it looked. It was never part of the Border Patrol initial plan for the barrier. It adds a lot of maintenance costs. It doesn't actually increase the temperature of the steel. What I've observed over the years is almost as soon as they put it out there in the desert, it starts to peel.
Mm. So let's talk about where this is a little bit more. You mentioned it's really remote. Is this a place where we have traditionally seen a lot of border crossings?
No, this is one of these areas that was never a priority for the Border Patrol in terms of construction because it doesn't have a lot of drug smuggling activity or migrants crossing. But part of that is because Highway 2 on the Mexican side of the border, which, you know, is the main kind of east-west corridor in northern Mexico, it isn't anywhere near the San Rafael Valley. It goes far south of the border there. And so there aren't a lot of crossings there. There has not been a big need for, a heavy enforcement presence. And since CBP installed the camera towers years ago, it's been pretty quiet.
Right, right. You write about just how much the kind of reasoning from the Trump administration has changed here. Like during the president's first term, areas like these were left alone for reasons like that. Why do they say they're building this now?
Well, you can remember Trump's first Homeland Security Secretary in his first term, John Kelly, used to say, "We don't need a border wall from sea to shining sea."
Right.
And there were restraints on the, you know, the kind of ambitions of the project. Some of them were financial restraints, but they were also some common sense restraints on the need to actually try to build through these very steep, rugged, mountainous areas where few people try to cross. But all of that thinking is now out the window because the administration has all this money to spend, $46 billion. And so, you know, the sky is the limit, and they're just going to blast their way right through these remote areas in order to complete the president's vision for a massive, you know, border wall.
Right. And this is just a small part of that big vision, right? So you talk about some of the environmental impacts. There are plans to even go through places like the Tanahatam Reservation, which sits along the border, which has been exempt in the past. This is a national memorial, as we mentioned. What about environmental protection laws?
Those have been waived by the administration. There's really no restraints that are on, you know, Customs and Border Protection to issue these contracts, to hire these companies to dynamite the land and build the structure. They're in a place like the San Rafael Valley where water is a lifeblood and is so crucial to not only the ranchers but also the wildlife in this area. They're pumping groundwater at a furious pace out of this aquifer in order to mix concrete to build the wall. And so, these areas are going to be increasingly stressed because the water is being used for border wall construction.
Mm. There are lawsuits from environmental groups over this. You talk about how this area is where jaguars have been spotted kind of returning to the region. I want to ask you before I let you go about some time you spent with one of these environmental folks along the border who has put cameras along the border wall, sort of documenting where wildlife is being blocked. And he also documented a place where people were not being blocked, but environmental, but wildlife were.
Yeah, I'll try to describe this quickly, but we went out to check some checked some trail cameras that have been set up at some openings. They're called floodgates, and they're during monsoon season, they're left open by the Border Patrol so that the border wall doesn't get knocked down by all the debris coming down the washes, mm-hmm. During the monsoons. And so he has a camera set up at one of these and periodically checks to see. And what we saw was a mountain lion approaching the border wall, finding its path blocked and, looking very confused by this structure suddenly cutting off its habitat. And on the same camera, not long after, we saw an image of four men wearing camouflage, rappelling down, lowering themselves on ropes. And so here you have a border wall not stopping the people that it was designed to stop, but blocking the path of large, species like mountain lions.
Quite a contrast. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Nick Miroff, staff writer at The Atlantic, joining us. Nick, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation and Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vianne. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.